Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't going to be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Black won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folk got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, that is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk only control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You know you only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, well, who cares? Marching, they never changed anything.
Chicken wings for that money, even though they was no good. But you do get something for your money. But when you put your money in the church bucket, what do you get back? Hope and a future after you die. And my position on that, if I have to die to experience heaven, I don't need that religion. Mm. Anyone who tells me that I should be content with accepting hell on earth when the white man has his heaven here and the Chinese man has his heaven here and the Arab and East Indian has his heaven here, and they're even building their heaven in my ghetto, and you're telling me I got to die in order to experience what they are getting right now? That's a religion I don't need, because that's a religion for servitude. And so we have to put the black church to task and ask them, what are you doing without Jesus money? Let me tell you what they're doing with your Jesus money. Every black church in America has their money in a white bank. It is the white banks that are funding the regentrification ethnic cleansing movement. So all of us go to church. We put $3 million in the church coffers every Sunday. $3 million goes to a white bank every Sunday. And guess what they do on Monday? They take $3 million of black people's white Jesus money, and they give loans to white land developers and businesses and entrepreneurs to come into the ghetto where the church is located, buy up all the property, and force grandmom out on the street homeless. Now, grandmom been going to that church for 30 years. Grandmom been giving that church $50 every Sunday. And lo and behold, grandma had to finally face the reality that it was your Jesus money that put your ass on the street.
Mm.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And messed around, he saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I want to know what's in the door. He said, you sure you want to see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings, all of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on Not Meant to Be Way because your package is going to keep going right on by because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on Pity Way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, Don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad a cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Hi, folks. In this video, I'd like to talk about how to have a home with no house payments and no monthly utility bills. You may think that's not possible, but I do it, and lots of other people do it as well. I'm going to show you how it can be done, how it can be done very inexpensively, and just kind of give you some ideas for things that you can do that society and the economic powers that be don't want you to know. So stay with me for a second and let me walk you through this. First, you need some land. This is my piece of land, which is under an acre, about 3/4 of an acre. And that's really all you need to take care of most of the needs you have and for running a small homestead. Now, I was lucky enough to get this piece of property from family. It was willed to me when my father passed away. But I have also purchased small pieces of property like this for under $400. I have an acre down in Arizona near Sholo, Arizona that I purchased for under $400. I have 5 acres near El Paso, Texas that I purchased for under $700. So it's very easy to find a piece of land if you do some looking around. eBay is a good source for finding land. Tax sales are a good source for finding land. Family members may want to sell off a piece of land. Go around looking in rural areas, and maybe you'll find a farmer that wants to split off a small piece of land and would gladly sell you one. You don't have to spend a lot of money on land. Okay? This is land that doesn't have utilities run to it. It doesn't have a blacktop road that runs into it or driveway. It's rough land. That's what you start with usually if you want to buy a small piece of land that you're going to homestead on. After you have your piece of land, then you're going to have a house. You can have a big house like most people live in, and you can pay a lot of money for it and have a mortgage and be a slave to the system for another 30 years, or you can decide if you'd like to build a smaller house like mine. Paid for with cash. This is my solar cabin. The cabin cost me $2,000 to build. That does not include the doors and windows, which I salvaged off of a trailer that was being torn down. For the cabin, it cost me $2,000. It is 14 by 14. Downstairs is living area, dining area, bathroom, kitchen. Upstairs, I have a loft, bedroom, and an office. In my other videos, I take you on a complete walkthrough of this cabin, so watch those if you want to see how the cabin is as large as it is and functional on the inside. Up there on my roof, you see my solar panels. That's a 350-watt solar system that provides all of my electricity needs for lights, TVs, water pumps, all miscellaneous gadget, laptop, TV, run my vacuum, and everything else off of a 350-watt system. That 350-watt system cost me under $3,000. $2,000 for the cabin, $3,000 for the power system of solar electricity, and I use propane. I have a propane tank in the back of the cabin, and I have a propane furnace, fridge, stove, and on-demand water heater, and those cost me just about $200 for an entire year. And we have cold winters here, folks. Under $200 for an entire year for all of my propane. That is the only utility bill I have. I do not pay for electricity. I do not pay for water because I drilled my own water well. Before I drilled my own water well, though, I hauled water in. But drilling a water well on a piece of property is not that hard. You can either do it yourself or hire somebody to do it. So I have no monthly utility bills. I have a house that's completely paid for. And I have freedom. A freedom that you can't get when you're under the pressure of a mortgage and utility bills. I want you to take just a minute and think about what you could do with your life if you had no house payments and no utility bills. And I'm telling you, it is completely possible. I'm not going to go into any details of how to get out of the house that you're in. You're going to have to figure that out and talk to some professionals for some help that way. All I'm here to do is tell you it's completely possible. Now, some of you are looking at the cabin and saying, yeah, but I couldn't possibly live in anything that small. This cabin was designed specifically for additions to be built on any of three sides. As you can see, the cabin has no windows on any of the three sides. There is a window in the back door glass. The sides are 14 by 14. The cabin was built to have shed additions built on all three sides. This cabin is 400 square feet approximately inside with 200 square foot footprint. When you add on additions, you could add on an additional 400 square feet on either side and off the back, giving you anywhere from 800 to 1,200 square feet. The great thing about building a small cabin to start out with, though, is it gives you a place to live when you build on your additions, and that way you can wait and live very cheaply without any house payments or utility bills, and then when you have the money, you can build on the additions to expand the cabin. That's very good for a single person or a young couple who don't have children because you don't need a whole lot of space to start off with. This way you can save for it, build on as you want to, have the additions, have the extra room if that's what you want. Now, I live full-time in this cabin. I live by myself, but my girlfriend comes up here on the weekends, and we stay together, and let me tell you, it's perfectly comfortable. We don't feel cramped at all, and we'd much rather have a small place like this. It takes a lot less money to heat. It takes a lot less money to cool. It's a lot easier to clean. It's just a fantastic home. Now, I'm not trying to push you into building a home exactly like mine. I'm just trying to provide you with some ideas. If you wanted to come up with different ideas, a different plan, that's just fine by me. But if you are interested in learning how to build a home like mine, I do have an ebook available and a printed book available called Simple Solar Homesteading. Go to www.simplesolarhomesteading.com. You can learn how to build a cabin like mine or at least get some great ideas for building your own home. Now I want to repeat, I own my land. I have a house that I built for under $2,000. I have a solar electric system that I have for under $3,000. I use propane, which costs me under $200 a year. I have no house payments. I have no utility bills. If you want a life like this, it is very possible. You can stop listening to the media, and you can stop being put under society's pressures to live in the type of houses that everyone tells you you have to live in. You can live very inexpensively, and you can do this at any age, whether you're older or younger. If you're younger and you start in a place like this, imagine the amount of money that you would have to retire on, with no house payments, no utility bills, and freedom. Thank you for joining me, folks. Please watch the rest of my videos for more detailed information on each of the systems and a complete walkthrough of the cabin.
How'd it go?
We got one out of two of them motherfuckers, you know?
You mean you motherfuckers come strolling in here all walking tall and shit?
Yo, B.I., man, I'm saying, man, we was blazing on them dudes, man, you know what I'm saying? Just got in the heat, man. We was blazing, though. It was late.
All right, relax, man. I already heard. Go sit down. I'm not tweaking behind none of this. That's one less motherfucker that's breathing than was yesterday. You know what I'm saying? So we all good. But I'm surprised with you, though, man. Shit didn't get by you back when.
Well, my man's fault, man. I unloaded on the younger too soon, man. Gave him enough room to buck and run, man. I fucked that shit up myself, you know?
Hold on. It's on me. I had that kid in my sights, close enough to take off his Kango and half his dome with it. Couldn't squeeze the trigger. Couldn't do it, man.
Why not?
Wasn't in me, I guess. You know, whatever it is in you that lets you flow like you flow and do that thing, it ain't in me no more.
All right. So you done soldiering, but you ain't done. Could use you for what you got in your head. We're going to put you on a corner. You could be inside.
Oh, man. I ain't making myself clear. The game ain't in me no more. None of it.
but you ain't done shit else. You know what I'm saying? So what you gonna do?
I don't know. But it can't be this.
All right, then. We straight.
Man in his time, you know?
Yeah. He a man today. He a man.
Our top story at this hour, a murder case in the state of Tennessee is garnering national attention. And the spotlight is a woman who was sentenced to 51 years in prison for killing her captor after he solicited her for sex when she was only 16. After several appeals, the state Supreme Court ruled Santoya Brown, now 23 years old, must serve 51 years behind bars before being eligible for release. This move quickly sparked outrage by supporters who say the ruling was unjust and her constitutional rights were violated. And recently, during a Nashville event where the Tennessee governor was speaking, a group of protesters demanded he consider offering her clemency.
And you might get parole after 51 years for a victim of sex trafficking.
Thank you very much for coming.
And so, I'm finishing my question, sir. I'm finished. Governor Asam's going to answer me when I finish. And so I asked, why has Santoya Brown been incarcerated for 14 years for enduring harm?
In the meantime, Brown's case has caught the attention of Hollywood stars like Rihanna and Kim Kardashian, who have encouraged others to sign a petition for her release. To date, 500,000 people have signed that petition on a moveon.org. For more on this, earlier today, I was joined by Dee Watkins, editor-at-large for Salon Magazine and author of We Speak for Ourselves, A Word from Forgotten Black America. Many say this was an unjust sentence for a 16-year-old. Would you agree?
Not just for a 16-year-old, but for a 16-year-old who was captured and forced to have sex with people for money. What do you expect? A young woman in an abusive relationship who was captured, who thought her life was in danger, who probably thought her life was in danger at multiple times. Like, what do people expect?
Now, prosecutors were saying that this young woman went after this 43-year-old man so that she could rob him. And her case, Cynthia, was basically saying she did this because she had to, because she was in an abusive relationship, like you mentioned. But when it comes to this, let's say her intentions were to rob this man. Should a 16-year-old young woman, little girl, a teenager, have been sentenced to 51 years behind bars?
So one thing those prosecutors need to, you know, understand or think about is what were they doing at 16 years old? What was your mindset like? You know, were you in a situation when you were captured and being sold for sex? Or when you're in school and having fun with your friends and, you know, applying for colleges and things like that. Like, we victim blame so much in this country. No one's asking, you know, and I don't think anyone should be murdered. I don't think anyone should be murdered, but no one's asking, why is this man, you know, bringing a 16-year-old woman and have sex with him? So that's not the conversation. And then we're also not having a conversation about the person who captured this young lady. We're just putting everything on her. And we have to understand that she could not have been in a normal state of mind when that happened, and she was a child. So it needs to be considered.
So, speaking of consideration, Tennessee's governor is considering Santoya's clemency request, but he says he has a lot of other cases that need to be reviewed. So should we just anticipate that this could probably take a while before we get an answer about this request?
Yeah, everything's political. Like, you know, a lot of politicians, they just play games because they don't have to live in these types of realities. They're fortunate enough to have the things that they have, whereas his daughter will probably never even understand the reality that this young lady went through. And again, you know, I'm not here to pass judgment on anybody, but what I will say is just think about what you were doing when you were 16 and think about if your life was like that.
So I'm sure you've been paying attention to the news, and since, what, last year, celebrities like Rihanna, Kim Kardashian, they've been using their platform to protest against this life sentence for this young woman who won't be eligible for parole basically until 51 years from here. Do you think this type of pressure from celebrities
can make a change, make a difference?
I think it does because they have platform. And, you know, a lot of people, they don't really feel bad about some of the things they do, but they do feel bad when everyone knows what they're doing. So, you know, if we know you're the governor in a state or you're, you know, a prosecutor over a case where something so egregious happened and you sit back and done nothing, and all of these different people are tweeting you and calling your office and signing petitions and fighting against it, it can put pressure on them to actually do what's right. Again, this is, we're talking about a woman who was 16 years old in a situation that was beyond just unimaginable.
Hey, YouTube, thanks for checking out our channel. We hope you enjoyed the video.
Righty then. Hippie 1255 here. I'm about to embark on a trip to Deerfield, Colorado. I've only heard about it a few times. But anyway, it's supposed to be the first black community here in Colorado that was settled here in Colorado. There's not a whole lot of history I was able to get on it, but it's supposed to be a ghost town, but I'm pretty sure there's homes in the area. I'm not sure what it's like today, but it's about an hour trip, and heading that way now. If I see anything thrilling, which there usually isn't out in the middle of the freaking plains here, I'll be back. And I'm going out to take some pictures, some black and whites, and we'll see how it comes out.
I'm stopped here at I don't freaking know where, and I don't even know if you're going to be able to see this, but check this out. Isn't that cool? Anyway, thought I'd show you that. This thing is wild. Alright, back on it to the ghost town of Deerfield. Well, I found it. I thought I'd miss it, but I found it. There's the road to nowhere. And there's not a whole lot here, kind of like I figured, but I will, whoops, sorry. I'll take a picture. Or some pictures. Or some video. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to walk around and take some video. Show you guys what Deerfield, Colorado looks like today. Alright, I think we're on. Here we are. I don't want to walk in the grass because of the weeds. Because it's rattlesnake season. Look at that, they're even trying to hold it up. Shame they can't restore it. They really should, but you'd have to redo it at this point. Here you go. See that? Oh, the first African American agricultural kind. There you go. Bugs everywhere, and it definitely smells like really. I don't like this. Okay, I gotta look where I'm going here. There's nails on the ground.
for your safety, please do not enter this building. It is private property of the something Black American West Museum, Denver, Colorado, and presents physical and health risks from something. All right, there you go. I do not want to go in there. Need another body here to watch out for snakes because I do not like rattlesnakes and I do not have my gun on me. Nope. I mean, they've tried to put it up. All right, let's see what's over here. Good thing I wore my long pants. Look at all these freaking crickets. It's like a herd. Herd of crickets. All right, let's go over here. Ah, road sign. My daughter'd have that already. See if it changes. See in here. Everything's so freaking falling apart. Souvenirs, gas. Deerfield, Colorado. So I guess at one time a gas station was here. They even paneled the roof. Okay, back in business. I ran out of memory and had no empty some shit. Anyway, he's inside the, I think this was probably the main gas station here. Yes, I can get in there, but I know I'm not. Right. The flagpole sign or whatever, so I'm guessing this was the gas station. And this could have been where they had the pumps. Does that look like a gas pump? No. I'm guessing this is a toilet. In fact, I'm fairly certain that was a friggin' toilet. The shitter. Cool. Well, someone broke in. It's a shame. Yep. Frickin' people. That's a big one. Let's see what's in here. I've got to walk around a long way. Well, snow chicken. Thinking when they messed with this stuff. Ooh, barn light. I wonder if the light still works. Alright. This is the backside. Thank you. I hear you. And we're back by the garage again. Alright. Let's see what we got over here. They didn't build these very well back then, did they? Well, I guess since it was 1900. Ooh. Holy crap. Floor fell in. Check out the old stove. Nasty. Nasty. Snake hole. Nothing. Water don't work. All right, folks. Well, I think that's all there is to her. I don't know if you can see that down there. That could be an old barn or something over there. I'll drive down there in a minute and get it. I'm going to grab my camera and take a few pictures before I head back to the homestead. God, it's hot. It must be 100 degrees out today. I wore my Carhartts knowing I'd be walking in weeds. Key word here, walking. Cool. There's a shot of the entire town right there.
Okay. I don't know what happened to that audio. All right, today, quickly, 1 acre towns, and this is, we do typically at least one shout, highlight, that's a better word than shout out, of a tiny town. So 1 acre towns, well, let me think off the top of my head. There, we mentioned yesterday, Punkyville, Kentucky, population 2. The founder of it passed away a few years ago, but I think his wife or family. Let me give it a bigger picture. They have a 18-acre farm, and Punky, that was his nickname, took out 1 acre, and he set up his little town called Punkyville. And I guess he and his wife would have, you know, they had a gas station. Look it up online. It's wasn't designed to be your normal town, but it was his personal town. So Punkyville, Kentucky, Punkyville, Kentucky. Then a few months ago, we had on here Pastor Roland Strand, and out in El Cajon, California, with Meridian Baptist Church, and they built 6 sleeping cabins. Some people might want to call them tiny houses, but they were actually 6 sleeping cabins for homeless. And I think those six sleeping cabins and the church, I believe it's probably on less than an acre of land. I think it's less than an acre of land. I have to check back on that. But we just have 6. And then, let's see. Sticking with the title of the day. Mar-a-Lago. Now, Donald Trump owns that. But the Mar-a-Lago Country Club It's on less than an acre and a half of land. Less than an acre, and it's a private club, and anywhere from $100,000 to $200,000. And we mentioned another country club up in New Jersey. Their initiation fee isn't as high, but it's still up $25,000 plus $4,000 a year yearly dues. But they have other membership packages which you might come in lower than that. Okay. So let's see. Can I think of anything else off the top of my head? We mentioned because Mar-a-Lago is a residence. They do have guests. And some other things. So I'm counting that out as a tiny village, Mar-a-Lago, on less than an acre and a half of land. Meridian Baptist Church in El Cajon, California, on, I believe, less than an acre of land. They've got six sleeping cabins. And then which can probably house at least probably maybe 12 to 18, let's see, no, 12 to 18 people, I guess. At least 6 to 12 people, I'll put it that way. And then, let's see. Oh, we mentioned, again, Punkyville. And as we come up with more towns, we'll, one-acre towns in particular, we'll let you know. Now, before I log off here, let's go to my text messages. Let's see. Okay, I got something here. Let me read it. Texas massacre happened in America's largest illegal immigrant colonia. And major U.S. media won't say so. It says at least 50,000 illegal immigrants have changed the once rural East Texas hinterlands for the worse. A Mexican national is is on the run after slaughtering a family of five Hondurans next door, including an 8-year-old child, in a small Texas town, a 2-hour drive. Here from a town called Cleveland in Texas. American, let's see, let me race through this. Let's see. All right, Liberty County, the originals of Liberty County, Texas. Let's see, Liberty County, Texas, a settlement, Jimmy Rollins, the heritage. Settlement in the county wilderness, some 40 miles northeast of Houston. Let's see. Until recently, the loggers were very good. Colony Ridge, so quality of life in Liberty County. All right, let's do this. Let's look up Liberty County, Texas. And thank you for Liberty County texting me this. Liberty County, Texas. Okay. And what does Wikipedia have on it? All right, Liberty County is a county in the U.S. state of Texas. As of the 2020 census, it has over 91,000 people. It's a county seat. The county seat is Liberty, Texas, which was founded in 1831 as a municipality in Mexico as Villa de la Santitismia. Trinidad de la Liberatoria is a long name. Okay, it was organized as a county of the Republican Texas in 36, and his name was anglicized as Liberty based on the idea of American liberty. Now, this is in Texas, East Texas to be exact, Southeast Texas. Let's see, communities. It has a number of cities. It has one town. It has census-designated places. It's got unincorporated areas. All right, now, let's go back to this. Okay. Quality of life in what are they saying? Jackson Ridge and Colony Ridge. Colony Ridge, all right. Colony Ridge. Let's see if Tarkington, Colony Ridge. Actually, I see Liberty, Texas, but. Okay, I'm skimming here. Okay, Colony Ridge. Colony Ridge. I want Texas. Colony Ridge. Colony Ridge LLC. All right, let me go back to this article and make sense of all this. All right. Let's go from the beginning. Texas Medicine has happened the largest illegal, okay. The Mexican national was on the run after slaughtering the, okay, well, it starts off with crime, all right. In a small town, Texas town, a two-hour drive from east here called Cleveland. Let's see. In what is regarded as America's largest settlement of illegal immigrants, one literally exploding in population amid the U.S. government from permitted mass migration border crisis. In Liberty County, there is now spread in the neighbor Jacinto County. This is interesting, okay. Overrun, how Joe Biden unleashed the greatest border crisis in U.S. history, dedicates a chapter of reporting to the massive illegal immigrant colonia as a warning to America about the coming consequences of an unfettered mass migration event now in its third unmitigated year that has already seen more than 5 million foreign nationals settle into U.S. towns and cities. Following an edited excerpt from the chapter Forever Impacts, the originals of Liberty County, Texas, the self-described descriptor of a lifelong Angelo residents like Jimmy Rollins, who trace their lineages from early settler families, have mostly fled what they regard a ruinous, irredeemable change. Settlement in the county wilderness, now I'm getting more of this. Well, they're going to be, in my opinion, they're going to be more, settlements like this. And 50,000 in one location, that's quite a lot of people. So I believe you'll see they're here, and there's going to be more coming, and some people actually get very wealthy by setting up these settlements. But that's a whole nother podcast. In any event, one-acre towns or one-acre villages or one-acre hamlets, whatever you want to call it, they exist. There's a lot of them, like I said, in the United States. There's 108,000 towns in the United States. And a little over 32,000, well, anyway, from my notes yesterday, over 30,000 that are municipalities. So, and over 77,000 are unincorporated. So, all right, that's it for today. It's kind of slow around here. I got to stop staying up all night, man. Most of this year I've been staying up night and night all night. All right, well, I'm going back to my studio if anybody popped in and got their hands raised up. If not, today, now we did a highlight on three tiny towns. So that puts us up to, I think we're up to 7 or 8. Yeah, 7 or 8. And what are we up to? Let me look. All right, we're up to 8. Okay, before we go to the phone lines here, wait a minute. I'm up here juggling on this and some stuff. I'll tell you what. Hold it. Wait a minute. Let me get somebody civil. Malcolm, we'll be back in about 3 minutes. We're going to listen to about 3 minutes of Malcolm Gladwell. We'll be right back. Go to the phone lines.
Malcolm Gladwell is here. He is a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. His first two books, The Tipping Point and Blink, each sold well over 2 million copies in the United States. His unique take on the world ultimately has even spawned its own term, Gladwellian. His new book is called Outliers, The Story of Success. I am very pleased to have him back at this table. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Happy now, tell me, I said to you as you sat down, I am fascinated by performance and success, and success in terms of the essence of it, and how do you get there? Not that there's a magic formula, you know, but what can we understand about it?
No, it is. It's this sort of perennially interesting question, and there are so many different answers depending on who you ask and when you ask them, and that's why we keep returning to it. If it was some little simple algorithm we could apply, it wouldn't capture our imagination in the same way.
It is said that part of the reason for this book, and there is some personal biography here, you talk about your grandmother, was that you were in search of explaining your own success, this phenomenal success you've had.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it was a conscious attempt. I would never do something sort of explicitly autobiographically, consciously. But I suppose on some level, I mean, that question began to occur to me because my own success doesn't seem to me to be entirely rational, or it certainly wasn't anything I would have expected.
And you couldn't necessarily look at particular biographical points and say, aha, this guy is going to be either president or write bestsellers.
Yeah, it seemed that I got really lucky. I mean, luck is a huge theme in this book. And it's funny, and you know, we're not very good with luck. We either, you know, we tend to sort of discount it. We'd always rather give a kind of considered explanation for something than just to say it's happenstance. But you know what? A lot of the time it really is. And in the book I try and sort of zero in on what is exactly the nature of the lucky break that characterizes so much of truly outstanding success.
Okay, let's take an easy example that you use. Bill Gates.
Yeah, so Bill Gates is lucky in many ways.
Yeah, very bright.
He starts two ways in particular. One is that when he walks into eighth grade at Lakeside Academy in Seattle in 1968, there is a computer terminal sitting there with a link into a mainframe in downtown Seattle. This no one had access to a computer terminal in 8th grade or 9th grade or 10th grade or even college in 1968.
Anywhere else in the world.
No, and he himself told me, he's like, if there were 50 people in my position in 1968, I'd be stunned. And he basically spends his entire teenage years programming,
yeah.
Right? Because of this gift. And he would tell me one point, Paul Allen, his great high school buddy,
right.
With whom he co-founds Microsoft, discovers there's a mainframe down at University of Washington that's free, it's not being used, between 2 and 6 in the morning. So he goes to bed at 10 o'clock, sets the alarm clock, climbs out the window, whatever, at 1:30 in the morning, walks 2 miles to the University of Washington, and programs from 2 till 6. Now, I love that story because it's the two parts of his success are right there. One is the extraordinary desire and obsessiveness and determination and love of computing, but the other is the fact that he's a guy who lives 2 miles from a mainframe in 1973 that's free between 2 and 6 in the morning,
okay.
Right? Now, lots of people may have the first thing. Almost no one has the second thing, right? I could have walked for a month and not come on to a mainframe.
But this is central to what you're saying here, and so let's explore it in more. The Beatles.
Yeah. Same thing. So Beatles, I'm really interested in one of the other themes I come back to in the book is this notion of how long does it take to be good at
exactly.
something?
Exactly.
And psychologists who have looked at this in the expertise literature have said, you know what, if you look at a whole range of cognitively complex activities, time and time again we see that expertise is reached only after a minimum of 10,000 hours of practice. And that roughly translates to 10 years of doing something. And I do this actually now with anyone who's good at something. I could do it with you right now. I just ask people, all right, in your career, what was the point that you started to feel comfortable in your role? And it's always 10 years. It's always 10 years. And I'm sure if we did the math with you right now, it would come out to...
No, you're right, you're right, you're right.
And yeah. so this magic number of 10,000 hours, what that says is the first in a cohort to reach 10,000 hours has a huge advantage.
Mm.
So Gates having that computer down the street or that computer in 8th grade gives him his 10,000 hours before anyone else who was that age. The Beatles, before they come to America, get invited to go to Hamburg. They're still teenagers, and they become a house band in a strip club, and they play 8-hour sets 7 days a week for months at a time. They get their 10,000 hours in before the British invasion, right? That's why they're good. I mean, it's not the only reason, but absent that kind of intensive grad school in rock and roll, they're not the band that we think they are, and they don't make that splash when they come to America.
And I assume that you could look at people who have been great athletes where there's a demand for performance at a young age,
yeah.
and discover that they started practicing under very good circumstances very early. Tiger Woods would be exhibit one.
Would be exhibit one. And the key, what you just said is key, what you said under very good circumstances. This is not just Michael Jordan going out and shooting baskets. The term that expertise researchers use is deliberate practice. That is to say, focused, intensive practice with an eye to zeroing in on your failures and addressing them, your weaknesses.
Yeah.
And I'm sure, I would love to have a camera on Michael Jordan as a 16-year-old as he plays basketball and seeing, because I am convinced that that's what sets him apart, that when he practiced in a different way. And that he was constantly thinking about what am I not doing well and why am I not doing it well and what can I do to perfect it.
Because, he didn't make his team as a 14-year-old or something.
Oh, yeah.
The junior
yeah.
high team didn't make it and then became a star and got a scholarship to University of North Carolina.
What's interesting, just to talk about Michael Jordan for a second, unlike a lot of other basketball players, his game changes dramatically over the course of his professional career. And he's not a great outside shooter when he starts and has a, devastating jump shot by the time he retires. So he never stopped this kind of constant process.
He added to his arsenal
and
once he became a pro even. There have been lots of examples of that. People that had a certain kind of college career and then they found out once they got to be a pro that they needed to add to it. But what do we read into this? We read in this access to deliberate practice over 10,000 times.
Yes.
May give you the opportunity for success.
Yes.
The opportunity.
Yeah. Yes. And that's a big thing because, ultimately this book ends up with a series of kind of policy prescriptions, because it's supposed to be a way of thinking about this question of how do we help people achieve their potential, right? And there's all kinds of ways to do that. And the very simple answer from the book is you give them opportunities to work harder. And so I end the book, for example, with a chapter about the KIPP academies in this new breed of charter schools, which is really based on this idea. It's not, there's nothing fancy about what they do. What they do is extend the school day, extend the school year into the summer, have school start at 7 and go until 6 at night, and have them come in on Saturday. And for kids who want to work harder, they will give you that opportunity. And the insight is that kids who want to work hard can't work hard unless it's the school there to do it.
That's true, too. But, I mean, what separates the kids who want to work hard from those that don't?
I have one of the chapters in the book is about Jewish lawyers.
Yes, right? Exactly. It's wonderful.
And it's all about this group of men
right.
who rise from the Bronx in Brooklyn, children of immigrants from Europe, grew up, parents in the garment industry, grew up in the tenements.
Right, in the 1930s.
In the 30s and 40s, and end up at the top of the legal profession in New York. This is hunger, right?
Right.
So, and one of the central ideas in that chapter is this notion that it was because they were discriminated against as Jews coming out of law school and as a result forbidden to work at the big downtown law firms that they went out on their own and took up this unfashionable area of corporate law called takeovers and practiced it in isolation and obscurity for 20 years. And then
all of a sudden it became a big deal.
Big deal, and they were at the top of the
game.
And
they were prepared. Preparation meets opportunity.
That slight, though, at the beginning, the big fancy WASPI law firm telling these kids named, you know, Greenberg or Flom or what have you, that you can't work here.
And we don't care what your grades were at Harvard.
And we don't care what you, or in their case, NYU.
You know, right.
We don't care. That, you know, that slight is of incalculable importance. I mean, you just said that Jordan doesn't make his team when he's 14, right? Again, that slight is that, I think that is the kind of added psychological.
But do you have that gene in you?
Did I have it? I don't think I've ever had a slight, but I'm not.
Not a slight. I mean, I don't think it has to be born of a slight.
No.
I think it can come from, and that's the intriguing question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I just saw Rolling Stone. I mean, yeah, Rolling Stone has got a list of the 25 greatest singers.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And including John Lennon.
Yeah.
Now, talent had something to do with this.
Yes. Yeah.
But where do we put that?
You know, obviously it's there. What's fascinating to me is in the psychological literature on expertise, there are a whole group of psychologists for whom I have an infinite amount of respect who will stand up and with a straight face say that talent doesn't exist, that it's all application and effort. Now, I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but what that tells me is, look, we think it's this much, and it's not. It's this much. You know, it's some tiny fraction of what we think it is.
I believe that because I'm being fascinated by the subject of talent and performance and what makes people the way they are. I have, in the history of doing this, more than 30 years, this show, 18 years, I have never had somebody say to me, you know, the reason I'm so good at what I do is because I'm smarter than everybody else.
Yeah.
It is all because I wanted it more, I worked harder, I focused more, I sacrificed more, and more importantly, I had a deep passion for the thing.
Yeah.
Whether it was swinging a golf ball, hitting a basketball, doing scientific research, being a diplomat.
Yeah.
And they never lose it.
Yeah.
And it is their best friend, their very best friend. Everything else takes, you know, and then you get into work balance and all that stuff. Am I right?
Yeah. No, when I think about the story of the Beatles, what's fascinating about them, of course, is that they went to Hamburg in the 50s and were a house band for a strip club. Do we have any idea how miserable that must have been? 8 hours set. You must really, truly love rock and roll if you're willing to play as a house band in a Hamburgian strip club.
Exactly,
I mean, the nastiest situation.
Yeah. You're willing to take the sacrifices necessary to get there.
Yeah.
So what do we know about Barack Obama? I mean, here's a man who's had phenomenal success.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He's at the epitome of power in the world.
Yeah. Well, there's two parts of Barack Obama that fascinate me. You know, the second half of my book is all about culture, but the role that culture plays in success, and how different cultures had very, very different strengths in different. And so I spent a lot of time contrasting Asian and Western cultures, for example, and talking about how Asian kids are better at mathematics for cultural reasons, that there's something about their culture that's beautifully suited to
the
test.
Okay, well, this is intriguing. So tell us what it has to do with.
Well, I think it has to do. So we make this observation that there's a huge difference in the performance of Asian kids and Western kids on math tests, right? And we know it's not. We've refuted the genetic argument. They're not genetically better at it. And we also know that from a series of psychological tests that they work harder, and that's the key. They're just simply willing to persevere more. The application of effort is greater. So why? And I have this whole chapter, which is, yes, I think it has to do with patterns of agricultural practice going back hundreds, if not thousands.
Having to do
years.
With rice.
Rice. My father's European peasant ancestors, who were, in the wheat fields of northern England, probably worked 1,000 hours a year and had lots of holidays and were drunk most of the winter and sleeping and worked till noon every day, right? Their Chinese counterparts in that same period were working 3,000 hours a year, weren't drinking out off the afternoons, and weren't sleeping through the winter. They were putting in a second crop of rice. Rice cultures are renowned for the fact that rice is infinitely more labor-intensive than traditional Western agriculture. And I think that if a culture engages in that kind of intensive work for 1,500 years, it doesn't go away. And so you take that child who is the product of that kind of culture.
It makes you good at math.
You sit that child down in front of a calculus problem, and they're going to approach it differently. And, some people laugh when I give this theory, but here's the thing. No one has a better theory. Right? We don't have any other explanation.
I know.
And the difference between Asian and Western performance is not this much. It's this much. It's enormous. Yeah. Right?
I mean, that's always a very good question and a good argument. Okay, maybe I'm wrong. What's a better idea?
Yeah.
And nobody says.
Yeah. Someone's got to give you a better idea.
Okay.
Okay. Little technical difficulty reloading the board there. Let's see. I was just reading through a text, and then I went doing some surfing online about Colony Ridge communities. But I want to read it and digest and process and then make a couple of phone calls and then go after that. Anyway, 1 acre towns, we talked about three of them earlier. Meridian Baptist Church in El Cajon Church, and there's 6 sleeping cabins. I think they're all on, less than 1 acre of land. I think less than, definitely the 6 sleeping cabins. And then on the high end of life, Mar-a-Lago, President Trump's, he purchased that. But the Mar-a-Lago Country Club itself is on less than 1.5 acres of land, with initiation fees of $100,000 to $200,000, plus yearly membership dues on top of that. But it's on 1.5 acres of land, and less than 1.5 acres. But let's put that 1.5 acres. And let's see what. Oh, the third one. Oh. And we mentioned it yesterday, but we're bringing it back up today. Ponkeyville, it's about 1 acre big. It's a tad bit over 1 acre big. Ponky has passed away, as we mentioned yesterday, a few years ago. But his wife and family still have it intact. And it's part of their 18-acre farm. So Ponky, when he was living, he set up his own little town, and they call it Ponkeyville. It's in Kentucky. So, we'll come across other 1 acre towns, and that's we're up to 8 tiny towns. Now we've mentioned more than 8 tiny towns, but so you can keep track of this because we want to do one a day, Monday through Friday, 20 a month minimum. So we're up to 8. All right. Anyway, Monday we'll have another one for you. Or next week we'll have 5 more minimum for you. All right. Let's go to phone lines here. Now, before I go to the phone lines, Let's see. Oh. Township. But apparently one of the niches is Colony Ridge. Colony Ridge Communities. And we'll get more into detail because, next week we'll go more into details about Colony Ridge Communities. But with the, and it's from the angle we're going to come to is immigrant communities that are popping up and communities that are popping up in a tangible form. In other words, you have immigrants coming in, some legal, some illegal, pick your flavor, and they're buying land and they're setting up their own communities with everything they need in them. So now, in some cases, things are going left, but I had to bone up on it over the weekend to get back to you. 314 area code, your mic is open.
Yeah, L.A., those that developer is building 200 full-size houses a month.
That's they're moving.
They're in Cleveland, Texas, in Libertyville.
Yeah, I never even heard of Cleveland, Texas, so I ran across in that article.
They're creating whole congressional districts, and these people are illegal. Actually, those houses should be seized. They're not even supposed to be working in the country. But that's your Democrats for you. You talking about tiny homes. They building full-size homes. Over 35 schools that will be well-equipped. And these kids are going to come out and compete against black kids and probably anybody else. And there you have it. All these sanctuary cities, they no-go zones. And they're not building tiny homes. They're building full-size homes. Shopping centers.
You're right. They're building full-size homes.
It's one place over 200 a month.
Must be a sanctuary.
How are they doing it, Emily?
I mean, because Chicago is right there.
How are they doing it?
Well, I'm getting a list of. Hold on, wait a minute. All right, Texas. Hold on, let me look. I'm looking up sanctuary cities right now. Let's see. All right, now I'm looking at a map of sanctuary cities. Now, Texas has one county. That must be the county that you're talking about.
Well, they're not
the other one. All right. Let me
see. I just heard the map. You got down there in Harris County, Texas. At Harristown, Texas is owned by one family. The Harris family.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of them?
No, that's not the people that started. No, they're dead now. There were two brothers that started, that founded Harris County. But that's way back. So to answer your question,
yeah.
No,
so
anyway,
you know, just making mention, study that and see what's going on there, and report back Monday.
That will be on Monday because you get me with some facts here. The 200 houses per month, 35 schools. I've mentioned this on here before. When I last time I flew up to Chicago from Orlando, boarding the plane before any of us, it was, they were going to Chicago like everybody else, but they boarded the plane first. It was a family a nice, it was two or three families of Latinos that they paid on a ticket like everybody else, but they bought it first. And then on the way back,
on
the way back, it was the same thing.
You know, when I fly to Egypt, there's hundreds of rich Egyptian families flying from the United States back to Egypt. Plane is full. Of course, it would be the Egypt Air.
Right.
But,
well,
I mean,
you know, go ahead. I'm listening.
Well, no, it's just what you know, you know what you're looking at, but this is a whole congressional district, and probably more than one. But the thing is this: illegals are not supposed to be mortgaging homes in the United States. They're not even supposed to have bank accounts. But this is the Democrats that's allowing that shit to happen. You would think.
Well,
the Biden administration and his Secretary of Homeland Security.
Right. I know of some immigrants from Ukraine that, I mean, they're getting benefits out of, you know, what do you call those things? Put it this way, they're getting social services. So
if somebody
like
has to approve
this.
Yeah, these developers are having sewage. Meaning that the EPA would have had to approve their disposal method, and that goes back to the federal government. Anyway, I'll talk to you. I see you have a nice weekend.
Okay. All right, Samuel. Monday we're going to pick this back up because I'm glad, Pianca, you threw out those sets. They're building not tiny houses. They're building 200 houses per month, and they've got 35 schools that are up. So now this is what I was talking about earlier this week and last week, and we're going to bring it back up again next week. The civil rights table. You can sit on one side of the table or the other. To be effective, you really need to be on the right-hand side of the table. So what we call illegal aliens, what they're doing is and this is the chessboard that we're talking about, okay? They have come into the country, and I'm not hating on them, okay? It's fine with me. They're coming into the country, and they're sitting on the right-hand side of the table. They're sitting on the right-hand side of the table, and they're building 200 houses a month. Not 200 tiny houses a month, but 200 houses a month. So Monday, that's how we're going to kick off next week. We want to focus in on this. And I imagine this is going on now. The 200 houses a month, that's just in the state of Texas. So we're going to take a look at other parts around the globe. I've got a friend of mine who, now that's south of the border, illegals, just in one particular county or state. But we're going to see if we can get some, a friend of mine who's a landlord, and he's got a Ukrainian connection. So here's what I'm suggesting. Now, if you can, pick up a second language or a third language. And then if you want to make some money, because the next step, because when they're building houses at 200 houses per clip, 200 houses a month per clip, they're going to get political power. They're going because politicians, that's why I play the Claude Anderson piece every morning when I start this program. As a matter of fact, they've already got political power. That's why we had the concept of sanctuary cities in the first place. You're going to pick up more political power and if you want to match that, you need to, whatever community that you're a part of, you're going to have to start producing and to protect your interests, because my definition of politics is the art and science of protecting your own interest. That's my definition of politics. At one time they couldn't do anything, but sanctuary cities came from a critical mass of illegal aliens who were producing and paying tax dollars and bankrolling politicians into office. So we've got people south of the border coming in who have de facto political power. We have people coming in, have come in from Syria, Ukraine, and Venezuela. All of these groups of people have de facto political power. How did they get it? By entrepreneurship. That's the bottom line with it. Because we live in a capitalistic world. That's just the bottom line with all that stuff. So on Monday, we'll come back with these colony-rich communities. And it, like Bianca said, they're building houses, not tiny houses. So, let's see. Let me see if I can give some more information. We'll be right back.
From the past, how long can a good thing last?
organize some information here. As Bianchi mentioned, and I've been doing some scanning, but I got to go into detail on it, that within the Colony Ridge communities, which is mostly in Texas right now, they're building 200 houses. Now, this is illegal aliens, but they can operate legally in sanctuary cities or counties. Now, just to give you a snapshot, illegal aliens come in all different flavors. Okay, we, matter of fact, we can call it the Baskin Robbins of illegal immigrants. All right, I know of some illegal aliens or immigrants, rather, that have been in this country 15, 20, 25 years. They haven't been hiding, okay? They work jobs. They have cars with car notes. They pay rent. Some own homes. Once again, they have not been hiding. Most, and now some have come from the Caribbean islands. Some are here from Ukraine. You know, those are the new ones that I'm aware of. But they're not hiding. They're working. They're paying taxes. They're getting benefits from various local or county governments that are sanctuary cities or counties or whatever you want to call it. Sanctuary cities. Let's put it under that umbrella. So from the black people from the Caribbean islands, know some there, like, say, Syria, they're spread out. But a lot of them are prospering. All right. So Monday, and we'll probably have to do more than one day on this next week, because I'm going to see, you know, we're still doing our tiny town thing and whatnot. But I'm sure some of these people will be, because remember I brought up the five distinctions that around the globe you can find when it comes to setting up a town. They are municipal towns. There are unincorporated towns. And municipal towns offer the most services. You know, they offer a police department, a fire department, public schools, and all that type of stuff. You know, they have the social services office and all that type of stuff. Then, and 86% of the population in the United States, they live in these towns. Now, you can, municipal, the smallest ones have a population of maybe one or two people, all the way up to over 8 or 9 million people with New York City and everything in between. Now, then there's unincorporated towns, then there are closed towns, private towns, and company towns. Now, total in the United States, you've got about 108,000 towns. All right? That's, and then over 30,000 of those towns are municipal towns. They have municipal charters. Like I said, that's where 86% of the population lives in the United States. If you want to visualize that on a chessboard with 64 squares, that takes up two squares. That's it. And 77,000-plus towns in the United States are made up of the unincorporated, private, closed, and company towns. What's happening within the illegal alien community, the illegal immigrant community, and it's happening within plain sight, is, like I say, in this one particular location, which we'll give you more details on Monday, they're building 200 houses per month. Now, this is why I'm not a fan of state-sponsored reparations. I'm in favor of reparations because, once again, there's over 31 flavors of it the way I look at it. My whole thing is DIY reparations, do it yourself. Because while you got black folk in Evanston, Illinois, well, they already voted for reparations in that town. And while you got black folk in, and white, because I'm sure they got white folks and Asian folks, while you have people in California trying to get state-sponsored reparations on the, in California, and then in North Carolina, you got Asheville, they're looking at a reparations bill for the city of Asheville, North Carolina. While they're, because when you're trying to get state-sponsored reparations, or anything that's state-sponsored, you know, you got to have the study done. That costs money. That takes time. And, you know, you got to – there's a lot of money involved in all this other stuff. And then you got to vote, and it might take years. Okay. There are people that have come and gone in this life. For instance, I had an aunt. She passed away about 4 years ago. She lived to be 105. Now, I never knew her position on reparations because she had more than most people do in the United States anyway. She had at least 44 acres. So she was good. But, you know, but put it this way, I'm sure she probably had some friends somewhere along the line that they wanted reparations from whatever governments, federal government, whatever in the United States. They lived a whole lifetime and didn't get it. All right. Now, once again, there are over 31 flavors of reparations. I'm talking about if state-sponsored reparations is your thing, so be it. I hope it works out for you. But all I'm saying is you have people, and this is one of the flavors of reparations too. You have people coming into this country, and it was brought to my attention during this live stream. They're building 200 houses a month. They've opened up 35 schools. You don't have to wait on the government to give you anything. It's out here to get. So in any event, on Monday, we're going to, you know, process and get all the information. In all this, some of these people are starting their own towns. I'm pretty sure you have some illegal alien immigrants that are coming in this country, and they're establishing their own villages, their own towns. Step number one is to identify a piece of land, and it could be as small as just 1 acre or even a half acre. Mar-a-Lago, which Donald Trump owns, is no more than an acre and a half big. That's it. But he's got a membership built into it where the initiation fee is, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 up front. Now, last week we bought up Tavistock, New Jersey. Okay. You don't have to be a billionaire part of that, but they wanted to start their own town because they wanted to play golf on Sundays. They couldn't do it at the original place they were. So they said, you know, let's buy some land and let's start our own town. They have three households there, 9 registered voters, but their country club membership has over 400 members, initiation fee, $25,000 up front. That's only after you get 2 recommendations from members in good standing at the club. And once again, the 5 distinctions. Here's what this is headed to. And I'm sure there's some towns that are off the radar here with these illegal immigrants coming in. And once again, me personally, more power to them. This is a capitalistic country. The name of the game is capitalism. All right. They're looking at, because somebody knows, just like I'm talking to you guys, They're saying, all right, you know what, instead of dealing with a municipal city like New York City or Los Angeles, Seattle, Washington, all right, let's go to an unincorporated area and set up a town, and it'll be an unincorporated town, and it can be a closed community, which is perfectly legal, as long as you don't take, you know, government money to set all this up. Because I'm sure some people are saying, you know what, we don't want gringo money. We don't want Yankee money. Okay, let's set this up to be private. Let's set up their own private towns, which is perfectly legal. And I said this a little earlier this year. There will be success stories. I said within 18 months, it came in less than 6 months. So the people that want the state-funded reparations, all I'm saying is you might want to rethink that and get what you can get now. Because 200 houses a month is not, I mean, and the political power grows along with that. It grows with it. So on Monday, we'll have everything boned up on that and get it to you. On that note, everyone have a good rest of the day, weekend, and Monday morning we're going to start back with that with Colony Ridge Communities. Because you might want to start your own community where you're building or part of a team that this is Nine Friends in Action. Nine Friends is going to 200 houses a month.